Welcome everyone to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today we are excited to have Sanjay Srivastava. Sanjay is the Senior Vice President and Chief Digital Officer at Genpact, which is an 80,000 person digital transformation services provider. He is deeply rooted in the innovation ecosystem. He was a serial entrepreneur, is an advisor to Silicon Valley AI incubators and several startups, and a limited partner in digital-focused venture funds. He is a member of the Digital 50 and of the BCG's Digital Transformation Network, and was named by IDG as one of the top 10 digital transformation influencers to follow. He is a frequent speaker at various industry forums on AI, analytics, and automation, and writes on disruptive innovation, including in competing in a digital first world on CIO.com and LinkedIn. Previously, as a tech entrepreneur, Sanjay built four startups, an internet edge distribution, data center automation, predictive algorithm application, and enterprise software as a service. He received his graduate degree from the University of Minnesota and earned his undergraduate degree from the Indian Institute of Technology. So welcome, Sanjay. Really appreciate you being on with us.
Thank you, Sue. It's great to be here.
Yeah. I met Sanjay. He was speaking at an AI conference here in San Francisco, and he was good enough to be on with us today, so I really do appreciate it very much. If you are interested in Genpact, you can get on the internet, genpact.com, and Sanjay's Twitter is at Srivastava underscore SNJ. Let me spell that for you. It's at Srivastava underscore SNJ. So before we get into the dialogue, I want to give everyone a heads up on the administration of the call. Allison is going to put everybody on mute right now, and when we get to the Q&A periods, we will take everyone off mute. You can also unmute yourself at any time by pressing star 6. We are recording the session, and it'll be on our website by Monday, if not tomorrow. I will do welcome your call during those Q&As, but if you are interested in sending me an email instead, you can do that at sueb@mariposaleadership.com to ask a question if you want to be a little bit more anonymous. And please title it Wise Talk Question, because I'm not really flagging it. I'm not looking at my email too much here, so I can at least flag those. So, Sanjay, again, thanks for joining us. I typically ask the same question. I did read your bio, but I really would like to hear from you, like what your journey has been, and maybe tell a story about how you began your work in AI. Start with that, would be great.
Okay, all right. Well, Sue, I think you've covered a little bit of my background, so I don't want to necessarily focus on that.
Right.
I think let me start with Genpact and the work we do, and I think how we got into AI. The reality is we started, we think of our company now, I actually think about it as I look back, that we are a company in the third phase, or I think four phases in the evolution of our journey. And my company originally started, and I wasn't there at the time, in what was called the business process management world. In that, we took business processes that were run by large enterprises within the organizations, and we sort of sourced that out and ran it on their behalf. The notion was that we run it at scale in volume and apply quality and discipline and in terms of a job one focus, and that would deliver better results to those corporations who invariably couldn't see it as job number one, they see it as job number 17 or 18 on the list. And that's the starting point of the company, and we were lucky in some ways because we caught the talent wave in India very early and built and gained off of that. We also, by the way, started our life as a shared services within GE, one of the largest corporations at the time, and had a deep pedigree of knowledge and understanding. And so that was the first 10 years of the life of the company. And, you know, in the end of that journey, we came to be kind of the leader in the market for business process outsourcing. And that was really the starting point. But as I look back now, I mean, that journey, the number one thing I believe we got out of the journey was this notion of blueprints or maps. And in sort of my language, and I come from the computer industry, this notion of actually having a business metric. Take one, for example, being DSO, DSO is outstanding. We're in the finance and accounting world a lot. We look at a DSO, we could break it into the end-to-end process from invoice to cash. We could break it down into five levels of detail. We call L1, L2, L3, L4, L5. And as we work with companies, we figure out best practices, thresholds, benchmarks. And you could just visualize the screen now. You can think about a board. You can start seeing that the top-level metric broken down, and you have an actual blueprint that talks about these gears and knobs and levers and control points. And as you do more and more of this, we basically developed a really good science. So we could go into an environment and you could say, this is the objective. There are the three knobs you need to turn, and this is the lever and the pedal you need to let go, right? And so it was very much scientific. And it helped us actually do our job at the time. But what it really did is allowed us to transition from there into the second phase of our business. We came to become an intelligent operations leader. In that, we still took on the work, except instead of doing it the old way, we started applying new digital technologies. We had applied a ton of automation or analytics or artificial intelligence components to it. And we tested, tried, we piloted, vetted, and in the process, we curated technologies that really worked for us. We did it at our own risk, with our own skin in the game. And I think on the other end of that journey, is a five-year journey, we came out as a leader in intelligent operations, but it's the idea of applying digital technologies to transform and to deliver the same end results, or the same processes with better end results. And that was the second phase of our journey, which then allowed us to come into now the third, which is where we are. Today, we're a digital transformation company, as you called out in your introduction to me. Mm-hmm. But I think the key thing there is, you know, oftentimes we'll go in, we'll journey map a existing customer experience, we'll think about the end-to-end process, we'll actually re-engineer the entire process from start to finish to drive a better customer experience. We'll apply automation, we'll apply analytics, we'll apply AI components, and then we'll deploy that a new re-engineered business process with new digital technologies, and oftentimes we'll just completely allow clients to just take over and run it. So we've turned 180 degrees in some ways from the exact starting point of our company. It's been the evolution in our businesses. Today we're digital transformation companies. I run a set of digital technologies in a business that spans most of our managed services world and all of our transformation services world. So it's actually where we are. But even as we do that, even as we actually become leaders in the space, I mean, our sights are set on actually moving to the next one, and that's the world of AI, and we want to become a leader in AI. And the thing we've come to realize about AI is that the materialized value of AI in an enterprise context is at the intersection of digital technologies and domain. Because as much as you can use horizontal pieces of AI, it's the contextualization, it's the goal orientation, as we call it in machine learning, that actually tunes the AI to be used in the way you want it to be used. And that requires a significant understanding of the domain and the business process, because you'll have to handshake with it either side. And data, and being able to label the data. And we think that we play in that world because we partner with AI companies, and then we apply our domain understanding to tune the AI to be able to work in that business environment. And we think of ourselves, so going back to your question, I think about the journey, and I think the company, the journey is actually a great example of transformation happening at scale, where we've taken an 80,000 employee company, and we've gone from being a leader in business process outsourcing to then being a leader in intelligent processing, intelligent operations, to now becoming a leader in digital transformation. And even as we are here with a mindset and a set of strategic investments we're making now to becoming a leader in AI. And so I think that's the journey. And some of that is obviously reflected in some of the work I've done as well personally, but you already covered that. I've enjoyed being an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. I think it's the most innovative ecosystem in the world, bar none.
Right.
I have benefited from teams that are just exceptional and world-class, and investors and venture capital that has been very supportive and an ecosystem. And, you know, we've had a lot of fun along the way. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks, Ray. It sounds like it's interesting to hear the journey from the business perspective, the company perspective, because your actual company has gone through a transformation as well. So it sounds like you guys are doing great. And I do want to focus on the AI. As you know, we are spending this every year we have a topic, and this particular topic this year is on AI and society. And so we had an Ephesus last month, and, having you on is obviously the complete opposite in terms of, like, wanting to get juicy into the the real practical use of AI that your company is helping people with, and as do others. So before we get into that and some of these trends you're seeing and some of the ways we can use AI practically here, I'd like you to set us up, because there's a variety of people on the call in terms of their understanding of AI. Some know it very well and some know nothing about it. So I just want to kind of get us all on the same page in terms of what are the different my understanding of AI, there's three different types of AI, narrow, general, and super. If you can kind of explain your understanding of AI, and obviously most of our discussion is going to talk about the narrow idea of AI, but if you could explain that first, that would be awesome.
Okay, well, there's so much terminology out there, it's difficult to just keep on top of it, but I'll give you my very simple, plain vanilla understanding. And before I get into those three types of AI, I think it's worthwhile spending just a minute on AI itself. Look, I grew up learning software programming in my undergraduate school. And basically, the way you think about software programming and automation, actually the word is automation, is a series of if, what if, then statements, or if, then except statements, right?
Yeah.
So if I get a invoice or a claim, and it says this, then do this other thing, except when this happens, right? So this is basic programming logic. You essentially figure out all of the if-then-except statements around any business process. There'll be hundreds of these. And once you've got that in your head, you can actually write out a software program that basically says all those things. And because you've automated, you put in a software program, it can actually run faster than perhaps you and I can. And it can certainly run at scale. In other words, it can do hundreds of my job instead of just finding hundreds of me, right? So the value of automation has come from the fundamental concept of software design, and the design is associated with understanding all the business rules and programming that is. And the better you do that, the better the automation program you have. I think in contrast to that, we must understand this. AI is very different because it doesn't start with that as a starting principle. It's not what I learned when I went to school. I see my teenage boys now use AI, and the young one is actually middle school. The older one is in sophomore at high school, and they're more comfortable with AI today, with classifiers and so forth, than I was with software programming when I was at their age. And what's happening is AI is different because it's a fundamental paradigm shift. And what we say is, instead of doing the if then except, we're saying, actually, I'm not going to teach you how to program. I'm not going to tell you how to figure out the answer. What I'm going to do is, I'll tell you the question, and I'll tell you the answer every single time, and I'll tell you when it's right and when it's wrong. And by my doing that millions and millions of times, I need you, the computer, to be able to figure out how to program yourself. And that's really simple, I mean, elemental, if you will, but a foundational change in the way we think about programming to go from if then except to right answer, wrong answer, figure it out yourself, has completely changed the paradigm.
Yeah, I've got a teenage kid.
It's that's another story in itself. So that's the world of AI, right? So that's why AI is so different, so profound, because it just opens up a lot more opportunities than we could do with traditional automation. And now you've got all these last mile problems that could never be solved with automation that for the first time are completely solvable. And so at the root of it, you have the ability to change the future of work on the back of that, and why there's so much excitement across the world and in enterprises around that. But to your question, you know, look, AI can span a variety of spectrums. And you know, and I think your use of narrow, general, and super is a great one. So let's get the super AI, super intelligence off the table. So the idea of super AI is that it'll function above the general combined intellectual processing capability of a human being and multiple human beings together. That's sort of the ultimate endpoint. I don't think we're ever going to get there. But, you know, there's obviously a lot of talk in the industry, and a lot of the gloom and doom comes from the back of that.
Right.
Really, you know, it's my personal view that's not even open for discussion. But, you know, certainly I can tell you professionally that in the enterprise world, that's a discussion that's not even on the table. I mean, no one's sitting concerned about super AI right now. I do think there's value in the discussion of general and narrow. And what we're finding out is general AI, which incorporates kind of the sort of things that you and I do really well and differently from current AI today in the industry is this notion of common sense, the ability to do two different things, both really well separately and yet tie them together, right? I could be driving down the street and focusing on actually driving my car correctly. And 3 days later, I could be looking to buy something and remember the ad that I saw on the back of my eye as I drove down the freeway and be able to correlate it. And they're two very different tasks. I'm going after a shopping experience 7 days later. I'm driving a car 5 days before. There are two specific tasks that are very, very difficult and very complex in their own right. But as a human being, I can correlate the two and I can draw inferences between the two. And that's generally AI. That's also something we don't really have in place today in the AI world. What we really have is the ability then to take the first one's definitely off the table. The second one is actually something to think about. But really where we're at today is narrow AI. And narrow AI is you pick a task and then you actually become really good at that task. And I believe our AI capabilities today in certain areas has great narrow AI that we can put into play. And so most of my discussions with, we serve Fortune 500 companies mostly, so large enterprises across the globe. We spend a lot of time with boards and CEOs and CXOs, and I spend a lot of time advising and serving these clients in their desire to understand AI and how to productively put it into play today. And all of that discussion is around narrow AI. Does that make sense?
Right. And I just want to interrupt real quick just because I think it's important that we focus on that because I think that there's lots of publicity about the robots are coming and they're going to take over. And I think that that's the robot can take over a particular task, but the robot isn't necessarily going to be able to do what you said, which is a great analogy of being able to do common sense and do two things at the same time. What a human can do. So just to be sure, super AI is beyond humans, not going to happen in our lifetime. General AI is basically being able to do things similar to what humans can do right now, which is do two things at once, three things at once, multitask, or, correlate, basically. And narrow AI is a single task. I mean, just things like algorithms. But the whole point of AI right now is that things can go much faster. We can predict health, for example. We can predict things much faster than we could before. So it has tremendous implications for, obviously, business, for health care. I mean, Alzheimer's, for example, there's all sorts of things going on there. Anyway, I just want to make sure that that's clear to the people on our call. So let's take what
Rachel.
You're talking to with your customers. So give us an example. I want to actually have you give us some examples of what you're talking to your customers about. And then also, because I do want to be true to our topic, it's not just AI, it's AI in society. So I do want to talk about the implications of it too. So let's start with some examples.
Okay. Well, listen, I'll give you a few quick examples and we can get into any of them in a bit. But just let me just explain two or three different ideas. And these are all things that we do today. So first, we serve a lot of banks across the world. And one of the things banks do rather well is actually do lending into commercial portfolios. Think about a bank that actually is lending into small, medium businesses. And if you're in a bank, you probably have 5,000 or so clients in each portfolio. You have multiple portfolios that you run. And one of the things you have to do is to manage the risk and understand the risk so you can manage and govern it correctly. And so that process involves basically studying the financials of each of the companies in that portfolio and then assessing risk and then aggregating the risk too, and then managing it across time to see if it's going up and down. And typically, it used to be done with CPAs that would read these balance sheets and figure out the risks and aggregate all the scores and come with it. Today, we use AI for all of that. So what we do is we have the ability to ingest 5,000 balance sheets, no matter if they were in three different accounting standards and two different languages. We can read all of them electronically. We actually extract semantically and use computational linguistics, but we extract all of the information out of these unstructured documents into a structured file. And then we actually run all of the algorithms on top of that to calculate the risk scores and aggregate it to come up to it. The interesting thing, by the way, we also learned is that AI needs to be explainable if it's really usable in a practical business environment. So then we actually present a score, and then we allow the client to backtrack. So if you're a user of the system, you can look at a score and say, boy, that didn't look right. You could just click on it, and it would drill down into the subsequent set of numbers. So you're now getting into the portfolio. And you click the third one down in the list because you didn't quite see why that came up, and you could break down into the actual numbers. And you click the one they didn't like or didn't understand. It actually allows you to go right down, click and drill right down to that two sentences of the footnote on page 19 of balance sheet number 25, right? And it gives you those two sentences that allow you to come up with this score that are to that, to this, to that, give you the final number. This is the notion of explainability, which we're not touching upon now, but it's really so important to put that into play. So that's one example. In the pharmaceutical industry, we look at a bunch of adverse events, and you know, there's all kinds of adverse events that come through. You know, I got on a plane through to India, had a couple of drinks, had my penicillin, started getting headaches, showed up at the blood donation center, complained with the nurse, that's an adverse event, someone wrote it up, sent it in. Now it needs to be traced and tracked and reported to regulators along with everything else like that. And those rules are complex and they're changing all the time, and every country's got different regulatory standards, and clients that we serve in pharmaceuticals are struggling to just keep up with that. And the reality is, to solve it with human beings looking and reading all of these tweets and Twitter comments and LinkedIn, Facebook Messenger, and doctor's notes and medical forms, it's just a large task. And so we use AI to basically ingest all that information, to classify it into different types, to categorize it by different areas, to cluster them to understand deviations, and we actually can put them into structured databases. And that's the process of applying regulatory compliance in that world. So these are examples of how we put AI to play in a business, in an enterprise context. There are great examples of narrow AI, and we get great productive value from those kinds of applications today. I think...
To me, this is about taking things that have been especially even mundane. I mean, like, you know, a CPA looking at a bunch of balance sheets, and now you can automate that. And that changes, obviously, the role of the CPA. So let's talk about that for a second. Because I think that part of why we want to do this series and part of why we're talking about this is that there's a lot of misnomers around, like, all these jobs are going to be taken away. And I think that there will be jobs that will be lost because of automation, but that doesn't mean that there's not new jobs created from it. So could you give this example? Like, the CPA has to be trained differently, right? Their value changes. And so could you comment on that? Can you comment on, like, how this changes the future of work? I mean, that's kind of a big question. Maybe narrow it to a little bit. But I'm actually pretty positive about this, because I think that a lot of tasks will go away that we hate. like calendaring, for example, but a lot of jobs will come open because of it. So tell me a little bit about your feelings about that.
I completely agree, and I actually feel very optimistic about this as well. There's clearly a shift in jobs. The best way to call it is, I call it a click up, right, the shift up, if you will, which is a lot of the manual classification or the kind of, rote work will get completely automated. But I also think as a result of that, we will work on higher level problems around that. So in that example that I talked about, the risk component, look, managing risk is not about understanding what the risk is or calculating what the risk is. Managing risk is about doing something about that risk once you know what it is, right? So if you really think about it, you want to spend time solving for, once you've understood the risk, what do you want to do about it? You don't want to spend 90% of your time trying to figure out what the risk is in the first place. And so this is the notion of shift up. We want to take basic kind of lower level kind of values or tasks in that value chain. And we actually purposefully want to automate that, because then it allows us to shift up and actually play at a much higher level in the ecosystem, in the value chain, and drive much higher value in the mechanism. And frankly, we've seen this happen before. I mean, if you go through the first round of computing and all the stuff that happened, a lot of the data processing work sort of went away. And then what came on the back of that is, Excel and analytics and being able to forecast sales. And you're no longer actually inputting your revenue numbers from today, which used to be the task of yesterday. You're actually projecting the financial forecast of tomorrow, which is the higher level task you want to go after. And I do think there's a big shift up. I actually also think there's a net new. And I can't tell you where the net new is going to come. I mean, I can tell you the profile of where the net new is going to be. It's going to be in that general knowledge.
Net new.
In other words, some will go away.
Got it. I just want to hear what you said.
Net new.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we talk about two concepts. We talk about shift up, which is, go up higher in the value proposition of the same work we used to do. And then I talk about net new, which is a completely new set of work that we can't imagine today that will come up. You know, think about
right.
Well, let's go back and think about what happened with PCs, right? Before the internet came along, who would have thought that there would be a career in search engine optimization, that there would be a career in computer graphics, right? These are things that didn't even exist. And now we have new professions around, you know, social marketing on the back of Instagram. That 10 years ago, we didn't even realize there was a world that could be. So these are new careers, new professions, new jobs that are being created on the back of advanced. And I'm looking back in history. I'm not, I can't tell you exactly where it's going to be in the future. But I think there's going to be a set of net new or new careers, new professions, new jobs that will be created on the back of the advancements that are coming through. So the sum total of the shift up, which is higher value orientation in current work, plus the net new, I think is a very optimistic story for the future, and we feel great about it. It has implications for employers and so forth, but yes.
So I'm gonna open up for questions here in a second, but I know one of the questions that is gonna ask, that's been asked, or will be asked, if not now, but in a, it's been asked, so, you know, I went to the airport the other day, and I had and went to get him out of the parking lot, and you know, normally when I get out of SFO, there's a guy in the booth, you know, and I, you know, give him my ticket, and he does all that, and this time there wasn't nobody in the booth. We just did it automatically. So, you know, this is happening. This is going to happen, and I thought, gosh, I wonder what happened to the guy. Like, I'm concerned about I'm not worried about the folks who are educated and can shift, you know, to a net new job or can shift, you know, can shift to a different job within tech. But I'm wondering, and a lot of people are wondering about, like, what happens to the more, well, I'll just use the term more blue collar. I don't like to use that term, but people who have been doing more of the things that are now being automated, what happens to them? And so I'm wondering, so the reason why I bring that up is because I'm wondering what, like, your CEO, you've got an 80,000 person company, so obviously you have some tech jobs, you have some blue collar jobs, you have, you know, a variety of jobs at that big of a company. So I'm wondering how we reskill people is really the question. And is a Genpact even in that kind of conversation? If they're not, that's fine, but I'm just kind of curious what your opinion is about that, because it's something I actually am concerned about as a general rule. So go ahead.
No, I think it's a very valid concern, and I think it it requires significant attention. I do think there's a component of, I call it job displacement. I don't call it job replacement, but I call it displacement as opposed to replacement. But I do think there's a component here, and I think it requires active thinking and advanced planning. So look, I mean, I can tell you about my company. We're 80,000 employees across the globe, spread across many, many different countries. And we think as a company, and by the way, I advise, I mean, we serve lots of Fortune 500 companies, so most of what we do is with CXOs, boards, and so forth, of large corporations across the globe. And in many ways, they're exactly the same place that we are. So I think in some ways, they kind of potentially speak for the ecosystem. I'll tell you all my advice for boards, and actually what we have done inside the company. I think there's three big things we focus on, and it's important that we get started on that today, not tomorrow. I think the first one is on the talent and the existing workforce. And I think this notion of, I call it bilinguals, and I'll come back and explain that. But this bilinguals is a really, really, really important word in the world of AI. And so, you know, when I look at companies I serve, I actually no longer look at how many data scientists they have or how many AI engineers they have, or frankly, how many process folks they have. What's most important for me is how many people understand enough of one and enough of the other. So they're not going to be writing, you know, and prose and literature in English and in French, but they're going to be able to work in a world of English and French and seamlessly operate across those two languages and those two countries. And it's the same notion of bilinguality, but I apply that word not in terms of languages, but in terms of domains. So if you understand supply chain processing, you know, and depending on what role you do there, you understand the domain and the process and the world of supply chain, and you understand some of the digital techniques, either around AI or analytics or clustering or classification, classifiers, then you can actually play at that intersection, and that's what the world really needs, because we need people that can actually bring those two things together.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a real opportunity to take people that are in the domain, right, and skill them up a little bit on AI techniques. And by the way, AI techniques doesn't mean you need to write software code. AI techniques means you just need to, you know, be able to apply it. And by the way, we are all, I mean, in our home lives, we're applying AI day in, day out, and we don't even realize it. I start my car in the morning, and my car dashboard comes in and tells me how much time it's going to take me to get to my office. Actually, before I get in my car, it starts my car and actually gets the temperature to where I want it to be, because it knows the time I have left the house every single day for so many days, and it can actually compute what time I'm going to leave, and it'll actually get the temperature right. And then it'll tell me how long it's going to take for me to drive to work that morning. It's basically guessing where I'm going, but it's machine learned that based on my behavior over the past few years that I've used it.
Right.
And so it's at play. I mean, all of us are already using it in our personal lives, and there's so many examples. I mean, you know, you talk to your Siri from your phone and you look for the nearest Starbucks or whatever, and, you know, this is stuff we're all using today. And all of this just requires, and it's just that same kind of skill of using that and then cross-leveraging that with an understanding of the domain. So anyway, the notion of bilinguality is really important. One of the things I think employers I would urge CEOs of companies to do is to really take that to heart and start thinking about a strategy to cross-skill people and get into a space where their employees are bilinguals. And bilinguals have an amazing we have an amazing need for bilinguals in the work we do tomorrow. So I think that's, and it preserves all of the book of business they have. It takes all of the understanding, the depth of understanding, and all the hard lessons that have been learned over the years in that specific business, and allows you to take it to the next steps. It's just brilliant, right?
I use the word reskill, but actually I like the word cross skill better. So that's awesome. Okay. So you said you had a couple things, other things besides the bilingual in terms of talent.
I think the second thing we always focus on talent is towards curiosity and speaking last. And curiosity is all about people that, you know, so it starts on the basis that we can't predict what we're going to need tomorrow. I can't tell you. I mean, I'm deep in AI, by the way. I mean, I live in that every single day. And even I can't tell you exactly what AI is going to come to next tomorrow and what you're going to use, right? This is evolving so fast. So the notion that we have a employee set that has a set of skills and they can just do whatever task comes at hand is completely ridiculous. It just does not exist. And so you need to have a sense of curiosity. You want to have the ability to learn. You want to be able to have the dexterity to pick up new things. And so the focus and curiosity is really important. And then the flip side, and that's in an employee, and how do you build a culture in the company where employees are curious? Within the company, by the way, we've done an amazing job of really focusing on that as we sort of transformed our own company itself. But I think the other part of that is the inherent culture. You want a culture of speaking last, where leaders speak last, because you want an environment where best ideas roll up, and you want to have the listening skills to look through new ideas and new business model suggestions and new thought processes, and then be able to absorb them and make good decisions on. And so this combination of high curiosity in the employee talent and speaking last, or really listening hard, either way, speaking last in the leadership pool is just an important component. And I think that's the second one that's important to get right. And look, I think the third one, and I often talk about it to CEOs, and I feel passionately about this, is the whole area of digital ethics, because the reality is we've got an amazing compute engines now and a processing power that's unmatched in the history of mankind. And then we have algorithms and AI techniques, the likes of which we've never had in our history. And those combined are giving rise to all of this wonderful opportunity we see. And yet, it's for the first time. There is no history book. There is no manual. There's no guidelines. There's no framework that's written, because all of this is yet to play out, or is played out as we speak dynamically. And in that world, I think thinking long and hard about ethics and really thinking about governance as you start the journey into AI becomes really important. And whether you just embrace AI and use other people's AI, as I've just talked about in my business life, in my personal life, or whether as an employer you actually get involved in AI and start using components, and it's inevitable that. So here's my other thing, by the way. When I talk to clients, I think the discussion of whether AI is long over, that time is coming on. No board I'm talking to is saying, do you think we may need AI? Or do you think whether we should, you know, is there a question whether we should be invested in it? So it's a foregone conclusion. Every company now is the mindset we need to get into, right? The question is when, right?
Right.
And so, that's where the world's at now. The puck is, that's what it is. And so, back to the point of digital ethics, I think it's super important to get started on that journey early, think through diversity, think through governance, think through application of ethical, you know, there's whole security footprints and so forth, and design that early in this journey. So anyway, those are the three things. I think this notion of bilinguals and cross-skilling, that's a really important one. I think this notion of curiosity and speaking last in the leadership is an important one. And I think getting a head start on digital ethics, which is going to be one of the largest things we need to worry about, starting on that early is another big one that's on my list.
Nice. Okay, that's awesome. So I want to open it up right now. We've got lots to talk about here. You could say your name and also your question to Sanjay or comment. We've lots to talk about here in terms of the types of AI, the applications of AI. I loved your answer around, you know, talent. You've got being bilingual and curious and the ethics. So who would like to raise their hand, so to speak?
This is Tommy Lees with Mariposa. Sanjay, I'm wondering what you, when you go into your client companies when you guys are doing your thing, what resistance do you get? Like, what are some of the big themes that you get as you go in there and are, you know, doing your mapping and working with people? What are you hearing from the people that are there in these companies trying to figure out how to use AI?
Yeah. So look, I think when we walk into a company and the question is, how do we use AI? For the most part, those companies have already made the decision to get in, and they picked a spot or two where they want to apply it, and then they bring us in. So if that's the part of the journey, let me talk through sort of what comes next there.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are two or three things that are real practical challenges around AI. I think the first one is not all AI is created equal. And what I mean by that is, you know, the reality is we think about AI as this one-step shop, this one monolithic, you know, answer to every problem kind of an approach. But in reality, it's broken down. There are many different approaches to AI, right? I mean, there's AI that thinks about language. We call the natural language processing. It's around understanding words, if you will. There's AI that's around conversation. So now, you know, you can turn to your Siri and say, what's in your Starbucks? I can turn to my Google Home and say, what's in your speech? You're not actually asking for the same thing. We're asking for a beverage, and then you go deeper into the conversation, and you have to hold the thread together in a conversation. That's conversational AI. Then you have vision, which we call computer vision, which is you look at an image, and you can disambiguate what the image is and classify it into, you know, it's a shopping cart with it's a screwdriver head of this proportion and this dimension. You know, I use that oftentimes on TV retailers. Or it's a car with a damaged front panel that is going to have to go through a claims loss of so much. We built an AI capability around that as an example. So that's computer vision. And then, you know, there's deep learning systems, because much of the knowledge that is captured in the domain eventually will get sort of captured in machine intelligence, and you have to build richer knowledge graphs. You have to build knowledge microservices. So there's different kinds of AI. The main point is, there are many different toolkits in the box. And when you look at a problem, you have to actually pick the right toolkit. So, you know, when I gave you the example earlier on the financial statements, the reality is there's simple parsers, very well-established parsers, Stanford, we use Chicago. They're really good parsers. But they solve for the problem mathematically. So you say apple's a red fruit, red fruit is an apple, and keep going that over and over in different ways. Eventually it figures out apple is red. And then, so that's vector-based language processing. It allows you to classify and understand what it means. But, you know, when you don't have millions of documents, when you don't have, you know, when I go do financial statements, I don't have 100 million statements. I have 10,000 at best. And now how do you apply AI? And it turns out there are different kinds of language processing techniques. One's called computational linguistics, which is what we use. And computational linguistics, the same thing, understands language, except it doesn't do based on math. It does it based on how a child would deconstruct a sentence and then reconstruct it back to see what it means. So different techniques. And the point is, you have to understand how and what the problem is and how to solve it, and you have to pick the right tool from the toolbox. And so one of the things we spent a lot of time on, coming now back to the question you asked, sorry, for the long explanation, is not all AI is created equal. There are many different tools in the toolkit, and picking the right one for the right job is a really, really important part of the process. And we spend a lot of time making sure that is done correctly, because once you get that right, the rest of the journey is much simpler. And then I think beyond that, there's the notion of explainable AI, because the reality is just saying, here's the right answer, trust me, well, that doesn't really work. It doesn't work in a business world. I mean, you know, for most of these companies, these are mission-critical applications. Many of them are in regulated environments. Regulators have to certify that. You can't just say, trust me. I mean, you have to be able to explain it and show it. And even if it's not as, you know, if you're not regulated and you don't have those constraints, the reality is business adoption is going to come when people believe in it. So explainable AI and how to make the AI actually even build a package in a way that it can be explained is another big thing to focus on. And then, as I said earlier, kind of governance is really high on our list of priorities. So picking the right tools is important. Putting the governance in place, super important. And really making it explainable at the end of the day is super important. Those are probably the two or three things that really come to mind.
Thanks for that. Tony, you have a follow?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Hi. So I'm really excited to hear about the enormous opportunities that this big data and using AI to generate intelligence from that is surfacing. But I'd love to hear a little bit more from your guest about how that positive wave might be countered with out-of-hand surveillance in this country recently, but also rising in China and now India.
Okay, Sanjay, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, first off, and by the way, I happen to be in one of those countries just at the moment, so I relate to what you're saying. look, it is a real topic on the table, and we must not put it aside. We must put it on the table and work through it. So that's the first thing I would say. It is an important topic to get right. I think that I think there are two things that I always think about and I worry for and I plan for around AI. One is this notion of future work and this notion of work displacement, as we talked about earlier. And the other one is actually around security and privacy and ethics. Security takes a very different meaning with AI because, you know, when you talk about automation, you know, the risk surface is the software that automates. The risk surface in AI is not just the algorithms that actually drive the conclusions, but also the data from which the conclusions are derived. And because the AI result is so intricately tied to the labeled data that goes through it, you can actually compromise AI by actually just going and compromising the data underneath it, right? So you just increased your surface much larger. And so it requires significant thought. And you know, no problem is unsolvable if you approach it and try and attack it, right? It's when you don't think about it and you let it go out of hand when it becomes very problematic. I think equally one of the questions that is, so that's InfoSec, but I think equally ethics is another big one. Because at the end of the day, we're developing AI applications and making sure that they are number one, built with diverse inputs, with comprehensive data sets, so you've got all the edge cases factored in, and then applied with the right mindset, right? So one of the challenges we have is teams that build AI, if they're not diverse, they can underrepresent pieces of the solution, and that can get us into trouble. The other problem we have is that the data is not comprehensive, so it's more reflective of this, you know, the classic thing you talk about is you can't predict employee recruiting based on past employee profiles because you may already have a slanted or a lopsided employee pool, and if you just read off of that and keep hiring people like that, then you'll actually end up continuing that trend, and that topic's been discussed quite a lot. And it's the notion of how do you make your data more comprehensive? So when you learn off of that, you have the right mix to build off of it. I think the third one is this notion of when you build something that is really applicable in this area, can you apply it in somewhere else, right? So my face, which happens to be an Indian face, you know, really works with some computer vision classifiers, but doesn't work with, I haven't tried myself on Baidu as an example in China, but I suspect that that might not be the area and the demographics that was widely covered there. And so if you cross-apply different things, you'll get different results. And so planning for the right users of the application is both very important. So I do think that, look, governance is really important. I do think that there are considerations that we need to get through around digital ethics. And I do think that the cyber threat surface or the infosec or the security surface and the footprint increases with AI. But I don't think it's any different with any other thing in life. As you progress and you bring in new technology and new approaches, it opens up new frontiers. I just read an article and did some research on this on blockchain, and the reality is in blockchain, we've had all of this good stuff come out of it, but now the threat surface has become much larger. And so I think that's a natural progression in life. And I think the key about that is actually catching up on that early and building governance in an AI-first world right from the start. Security is not something you can plug in halfway through the build. It is not a layer that you attach on after everything else. In the old days, you sort of build a plane, and then the last minute, you kind of slap on a security cover on it. Well, that does not apply. You've got to build it right from the scratch. So anyway, long story short, I think it's a real concern, number one. I think it has to be addressed, number two, and there's ways to address it. But I think the key is getting started early in the exercise and building right off the bat governance into that AI-first world.
That sounds good. Great. So one more question, Sanjay. I'm going to let you go. It's 5 years from now. What are we looking at here? What's it look like?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll tell you what I tell clients. And I think the question that they then turn, they say, okay, well, that's very interesting, but what do I do next, right? And here's the three things I tell you right off the bat, I tell people. One, I think customer experience is where it starts, right? And that's where the puck is at now. So if you're thinking about doing anything in AI, to start with AI as a R&D project or as an experimentation layer or some kind of a broad-based approach to solving the problem in life, just throw it out, right? Because it's a non-starter. For most enterprises, it's a complete non-starter. You got to start with the customer experience. You have to think about an end-to-end journey, and you have to journey map it, and then you have to think about transforming it. And then AI becomes the piece, the tools that you use to do that. So there's a master-slave relationship here, right? AI is not the master. AI is the slave. The master relationship here is customer experience.
Yeah.
So start with customer experience. That's number
right.
one. I think the other one is, look, AI is meaningless unless you have the data. And the reality is data is a lot of work to be done on data. So what I tell CEOs is start building the data foundation today, because you're not going to get to AI until you have the foundation in place. And it isn't just about collecting the data. It's about normalizing, wrangling, managing, keeping, all that sort of stuff takes a significant amount of work. And so data foundation, key to AI, no data, no AI, get started now. Point number two. I think the third one I think about is collective intelligence. I think for the first time, we've really got to take a shift out of, kind of a mindset. We have to think about how do you leverage the ecosystem around you and how do you take the collective intelligence that sits around
that.
This is a fun project we're doing among, we do so many different things, but this one I just personally love. We're helping a Formula E, this electric engine, so Formula E race team around the world right now. Mm. And one of the things we do for them is that we help them basically drive performance on those racetracks, right? And so you think about an exercise like that, you've got all these variables that are coming off of all these telemetry sensors that sit on the car itself. And then we're combining that with satellite images of roads in Hong Kong and trying to figure out where the bumps are and where the curves are. And we're looking at all these photographs and weather data and storm updates, right? And so you've got all these different data. So we're looking at fan data and who's following what, and what are they cheering for? And you've got to combine all of these different data sets and then bring it to a point where you can take a satellite image of a bump on a road, convert it into what it would feel like to drive over it at so many miles per hour, and then convert that to the feedback you would get in the steering wheel if you were driving it so you can train your race drivers better. All of that's happening with AI. But it only happens because we can get that collective intelligence in place, that we can tap into the weather, we can tap into the satellite, we can tap into Google Maps, we can bring in the audience feed, we can bring in all the telemetry sources. So once again, I think this notion of customer experience, I think this idea of building the foundation of data for AI, and I think this power of the collective intelligence that sits in connected ecosystems, I think they're the three key things that I always talk to clients about in their journeys to AI.
All right. Awesome. Great way to end. Thank you so much for being with us. Again, if you want to follow Sanjay on Twitter, it's at @SRIVASTAVA_SNJ. And Sanjay, is there a way for people to get a hold of you directly at all?
You know, absolutely. I'm most active on LinkedIn. And so
Perfect.
If you just went to me on LinkedIn and just send me a message, I'm happy to connect with you.
Awesome. So again, it's Sanjay and it's Srivastava, SRIVASTAVA. Thanks again, everybody, for being on Wise Talk. Tons of learning. I took more notes than usual, I'll tell you that. So thanks again. Thanks, everybody. Talk later. Bye now.